This is a very rare and elusive species, one that requires lots of eyes and lots of hands and lots of inquiring minds out there investigating it. And as we'll touch on too, there's another dimension too, a much more personal perhaps and a cultural dimension that has a lot of significance. And I think preserving that and appreciating it cross-culturally is a very important aspect of this investigation. In fact, Chris and I were talking about the importance of that, and I was citing an example of a researcher up in Wyoming who has been doing oral interviews with members of the Eastern Shoshone and the Arapaho tribes there, and their interest in having their stories recorded and documented. So that they're preserved and better understood. So one of the other things I'm going to add to that litany of that assignment I received is also just to discuss a little bit about the context, both a geographic as well as a taxonomic and scientific context for this subject. And we'll look at it that it goes far beyond our own borders. And it's an important aspect, and hence the name of the title, Sasquatch and Other Wild Men, The Search for Relic Hominoids. Now, what is a relic hominoid? Sounds like kind of an ostentatious term, but it's really pretty straightforward. Hominoid derives from the terms homin, which means human, and the suffix oid, which means in the likeness of, something very similar to, but not the same as. Relict, on the other hand, and this is relict with a T, has specific meanings, referring to something that was once more common, but now is much more restricted. Something that has carried over from an earlier period of time, an earlier age. And so this represents the notion that there are these beings that have, as has been suggested, have been here for a long, long time, obviously, but that have been that are remnants now. They're certainly not as numerous as they were at one time, and you know, I think we have some stewardship for that as well. Now, from a strictly taxonomic, from a scientific point of view, the term hominoid actually derives from the name of the superfamily Hominoidea, which includes us and all of the apes, both great and lesser apes. Now, if we look, this is a very simplified diagram of that taxonomy. It certainly doesn't reflect the diversity and the numerous species that occupy each of those taxonomic groups. If we focus for just a minute on our particular lineage, you'd be a little egocentric here, and we look at the tribe Hominini, that those are the hominins. Now, some of you who are interested in anthropology, keep up with the terminology and so forth, you may think, well, what's a hominin? I thought they were hominids. Well, it just has to do with some of the particulars of cladistic taxonomy and trying to better reflect relationships by that taxonomy. And so the word hominid has dropped back to this point. You can see there the hominidae, which includes us and our closest relatives amongst the primates, the African apes. And now the hominins then specifically refer to these species, closely allied to the human family. Now, if we look at just that little branch, just to give you a sense of the diversity that really exists, this is a phylogeny that was created almost 10 years ago. And you can see how bushy it's gotten. As paleoanthropologists have continued to discover fossils out there, and they've added to the diversity of these human ancestors and human relatives, that tree has gotten bushier and bushier and bushier. And in fact, given the dated nature of this figure, as I said, nearly 10 years old, to make it more accurate, we'd have to add at least three more species to this phylogeny or this tree. What's the implication of that is this. If you go back in time, at any given slice in time, there wasn't just one, but there were multiple species of man-like beings, human-like beings, existing across the landscape. For example, if we went back to just about 2 million years ago, we'd run into at least four that we know of, bearing in mind that our knowledge of the, or that the fossil record is really only a small sampling of the actual diversity of organisms that existed in the past. But so we, if we went back in time and a time machine stepped out, we might bump into any of a number of these four species, one of which had a brain that was about, 900 to 1,000 cc's, about two-thirds our brain size. But right alongside were other upright walking, very man-like, human-looking species like Paranthropus boisei, with a brain that's just barely larger than a chimpanzee's, which survived until quite recently. Relatively recently, geologically speaking, about one to 1.5 million years ago, as the fossil record shows. But I'm going to point something out that may draw that into question. So the very famous anthropological artist, Jay Matternis, imagined this type of a scene. If you went back to the plains of East Africa 2 million years ago, or just under, you might have seen some Homo habilis wielding their stone tools here, encountering a band of Paranthropus. Whether that was an antagonistic confrontation as depicted here, or otherwise, that remains to be seen. Here's an interesting depiction. A bit of rock art from South Africa, from northwest South Africa, attributed to the Sandbushmen. And the anthropologist, the renowned anthropologist H.C. Woodhouse, who was an expert on petroglyphs in, throughout Africa, commented on this and described it as a band of these rather slender, gracile, weapon-wielding Bushmen confronting these stooped, very robust and weaponless creatures, man-like creatures. Now, you can't help but look at that, and he even commented that perhaps these... Am I doing that, or is that just a hiccup in there? That these could be considered as, according to the legends of the Bushmen, creatures from an earlier race, as they were referred. But could this be a depiction of Paranthropus surviving into historic times or very recent prehistoric times and being encountered by Homo sapiens? If we went back in time in Eastern Asia, for example, say we stepped out only, say, 20,000 years ago, we might encounter any one of more than a half a dozen different species of hominin. And in fact, the actual date of extinction of Gigantopithecus and Lufengpithecus, so this is the famous giant ape that has been suggested as a possible ancestor of Sasquatch, both in Asia and in North America, and contemporaneous with it were species of the genus Lufengpithecus, which was about a gorilla-sized ape in China. And then Pongo, we have on the mainland of China up until very recent times and now only persisting there in Sumatra and Borneo in Southeast Asia. But they could easily have extended far beyond the very scant fossil record that we have that consists of just a few isolated teeth and jaws. So the point is that in spite of this, there has been this prevailing paradigm, this mindset in anthropology that we are, as a species, the only hominin, the only human used in a very broad sense, standing. So you see books written by famous paleoanthropologists, this is Chris Stringer from the British Museum of Natural History, entitled Lone Survivors, or Nova did a series entitled Becoming Human, and the last episode was entitled The Last Human Standing. And they posed this question sort of rhetorically. Why is it that we are the last human-like species around today? But why is that the case? I mean, when you the point that I was trying to get across with those phylogenies is twofold. One, that in the past it was very bushy. There were many contemporaneous species. And recent discoveries have shown that many of those branches have persisted more recently than has ever been appreciated before. So why is it? Well, there's starting to be a little bit of a shift. Why is it that that mindset is so entrenched right now? Science tends to be very conservative. They're very slow to change ideas and change notions. Sometimes it takes a whole generation of scientists to pass away before a new idea starts to take root and get hold. And that's beginning to happen with the Sasquatch phenomenon. Well, with this notion of relic hominoids. Let's keep it that way first, and then we'll focus in on Sasquatch. Not too long ago, 2012, New Scientist magazine, which is to Britain what Scientific American is to the U.S., very popular science magazine, regular periodical, had a cover story entitled addressing the 10 biggest questions that we're facing students of human evolution today. And I was amazed when I got a phone call from one of their editors asking to interview me for the article entitled "Are Other Hominins Alive Today?" They were recognizing that this is a question that is begging to be addressed by the scientific community. So to illustrate, you know, what we're up against, if this puzzle piece here is the evidence that we have for relic hominoids, and we're looking here at the prevailing scientific paradigm, and there just isn't a place to put it. I mean, we learned from the history of science, if there isn't a context, there isn't a cubbyhole already existing, there isn't some place of accommodation, no matter how good the evidence for a new idea is, it will rarely get an objective and open-minded hearing. But eventually, additional discoveries begin to create a framework that exposes that missing piece of information. And now there's a place to put it. And that's what's beginning to take place as it's recognized that the rule, rather than the exception, was multiple species existing across the landscape throughout the past, and that, in fact, many of these remnants have persisted until very recently. So we have Neanderthal sites that are less than 10,000 years. We have Homo heidelbergensis in China that was 12,000 years. We have the Hobbit, and that's what really drove it home, was when Homo floresiensis was discovered on the little island of Flores in Indonesia. This little diminutive skull of a creature that was only about 3.5 feet tall. And these are two rather different-looking reconstructions, as you can see, interpreting the living creature from the bones can be a bit of a freewheeling exercise. But the discoverers of this 13,000-year-old skeleton, which by all intents and purposes looked a lot like a little Australopithecine that were thought to have gone extinct in Africa 3 million years ago, they said, well, you know, the local people have been telling us that there's these little hairy people that live up in the mountains, and they're really aggressive, they don't like them, they don't get along. In fact, there were some early European colonists to Flores that actually described them in their journals, having seen them. So, uh-oh, there we go. We're losing it. So this is a native depiction from the Nage people of Homo floresiensis. What I'm building up to is that incrementally, things are starting to change. You know, I'm sure you've seen me on a lot of documentaries where I'm juxtaposed with an armchair skeptic, often one who's uncredentialed to opine about this type of evidence anyway. But many of my colleagues will publicly distance themselves from this. But behind the scenes, there are more and more scholars, especially the younger generation that's coming up, that haven't been raised with the notion that Sasquatch was just a, you know, somebody with some carved wooden feet strapped to their boots, are taking a much more decided interest in this question. Those of you that picked up a copy of my book, you'll notice that the foreword is written by George Schaller, who's one of the preeminent naturalists of our century. And he's quite intrigued by the evidence. Got it? Great, thank you. So, yeah. So here's Chris Stringer. Remember Chris Stringer that wrote The Lone Survivor? And he said this after the discovery of Homo floresiensis. One of the first things I thought of on learning about the Flores skeleton was a possible parallel with the orang pendek. Now, some of you may recognize that term. The orang pendek are the little people, the short people, of Malaysia, which are, for all intents and purposes, from their descriptions, very similar to, if not the same thing, as the hobbit. So he's... What's interesting, there's two things that are interesting about this, I think. One, he was aware of that term. He was aware of the stories and of the accounts of the orang pendek and immediately recognized the potential connection. And second, that he was willing to say this to the senior editor of Nature magazine, the flagship, one of the flagship scientific publications. Henry Gee, that managing editor, went on to write an editorial, an op-ed, that in which he said and made this concession: the discovery that Homo floresiensis survived until so very recently in geologic terms makes it more likely that stories of other mythical human-like creatures such as yetis are founded on grains of truth. So little by little it's starting to open up. Still staying with the Homo floresiensis, Gregory Forth is a cultural anthropologist at the University of Alberta, did his doctorate on the island of Flores in looking at the mythology of the Nage people. He was impressed by the fact that this Ibu Gogo was different than the other supposed mythological creatures. It was described in terms that were more equivalent to the way they would describe any other animal out there in the forest and the mountains. And so he had actually made the comment and had published, had said in print, that the Ibu Gogo may be, as he called it, an empirical species. You know, very official sounding. And it was only a few years thereafter that Homo floresiensis was discovered. And again, the connection wasn't lost on those familiar with this. But he wrote, again, an editorial in a scientific journal, Are Legendary Hominoids Worth Looking For? And he's been a great ally, great support of the work that I've been trying to do, bringing this notion of relic hominoids to the forefront. Okay, so let's, from that consideration of the context, to see, at least from one perspective, from a scientific perspective, where this fits into our understanding of the evolutionary history of primates, of hominoids in general. Let's look at some of the specific evidence that is accumulating, the nature of that evidence and what it implies. So the distribution and the habitat. Now, generally, and of course, you have to kind of think of this a little differently down in terrain like this, especially when I hear the context of some of these encounters and stories. We typically, where I'm from, up in the Northwest and in the Northern Rockies, it's the wild man of the woods for us. This is a creature that requires the cover and the ecology of usually of montane forests. And in particular, I've highlighted in, well, the green here indicates a hypothetical distribution, a range map, if you will, of Sasquatch. And you can see that there is representation down here. Can't see it from this angle. It's kind of squat flat right there. We've got New Mexico. And the red are highlighting temperate rainforests. One, just sort of a speculation on my part. I won't even call it a hypothesis. But one speculation that I have is that the original habitat of these creatures were temperate rainforests that extended from China all the way across the Bering Land Bridge at periods when the continents were connected into North America. And remnants of that extensive rainforest in North America can still be found here along the coastal areas, along the Canadian Rockies, where they catch those westerlies, And then there are orogenic monsoons that occur from the uplift here in the Southern Rockies, in particular here in Colorado, that produce an inordinate amount of rainfall. But that, as was mentioned earlier, there is, before I go to the rainfall, that map, those of you who are familiar with mammals, that map is remarkably similar to the distribution of black bears, another large omnivorous mammal. In fact, so similar that there was a paper that came out recently. A colleague of mine, Peter Anello, he did his doctoral work at the University of Colorado, did one of his senior theses on a GIS analysis of data on Sasquatch in the Pacific Northwest, and demonstrated quite conclusively that the evidence showed over time a movement of encounters to higher elevations and more southerly latitudes surrounding the metropolitan area of Seattle, Tacoma, and Portland, Vancouver areas down in the Willamette Valley. He went on and became a senior technician at ESRI, the main GIS research center, and he and a couple of his colleagues published a paper. It was only kind of obtusely relating to Bigfoot, but they were actually critiquing some modeling software packages. They felt that, you know, it was too much of a black box. People were using these modeling systems indiscriminately without understanding how they work. So to show, they plugged in a bunch of Sasquatch data, distribution data, and came out with these patterns that were remarkably compelling. But to get the paper published, they took the position that, well, look, some of these software packages even produce reasonable data for Sasquatch evidence. You know, tongue in cheek. Well, and they showed the remarkable congruence between black bear distribution and Sasquatch distribution, and said, oh, well, there you see. That's probably the explanation for Sasquatch, is that they're just misidentified black bear encounters. And I called up Peter, because Peter has done some interesting work and has been, he actually wrote a very interesting geospatial analysis that was published in the journal I edit. But I said, Peter, what gives? What's with this? And he said, in order to get the paper published, we had to include that kind of language, because the editor wasn't going to send it out to reviewers even until we did. And he said, my co-authors weren't willing at this point to put their name on a paper that seemed to vindicate the legitimacy of evidence for Sasquatch, even though they're really interested in this and they were really impressed by the outcome. So that's kind of the uphill or upstream struggle that we have. It was mentioned about rainfall. And so here's a precipitation map. There is a rule of thumb, and this has been identified from long ago. John Green wrote about it probably 30 years ago, that the majority of credible Sasquatch encounters can be encompassed within areas that have 18 plus inches of precipitation a year. And so, you know, if you look at New Mexico, don't bump that cable, whatever you do wrong. you can see here there are areas where we have quite a bit of rainfall that at least would fit that. Now, are they restricted absolutely to those areas? Probably not. I mean, I think those are their primary habitats. But just as with black bear, they're able to, you know, they're quite they're generalists, quite adaptive, and may have moved out into other areas for various reasons, whether dispersing, whether foraging, or whatever. And then here's a map showing forest cover, forest distribution. And so you can see that that there is habitat that fits that stereotype. But I, you know, given all that I've learned since I've been here so far and things that I've read after agreeing to come down here, there's interesting other possibilities. The point is, though, that there is an ecological basis. This is not doesn't seem to be something that just, you know, steps out of the ether whenever and wherever on a whim. You know, they don't show up in Central Park in New York City. And one thing that really illustrated this, and I hope it'll impress you as well. I was on an airplane reading a magazine, and there was an article about the imperiled status of Asian tigers, and a graphic jumped out at me. Because now remember, to preface this, as I suggested, there are almost certainly Sasquatch equivalents found throughout Asia. And I'd been collecting examples of footprint evidence, both casts and photos of footprints, from China, from Vietnam, from India, from Central Asia, and filing these away for eventual analysis. This figure jumped out at me. The lighter colored, orangish color, is the past distribution of these Asian tigers as of 1900, I think that is, isn't it? Yep. And then the bright red is now the remnant refugia of this species as of 1990. You know, the habitat has been fragmented, degraded, encroachment of human populations and hunting pressures and so forth. But what's interesting is look at the distribution of these footprints, where they hail from, where they originate. They all come from areas where the tigers are now a mere remnant, or where they're thought to have gone extinct, although there still persist a few isolated encounters. Asian tigers here up in the Pamir and Altai region. There was even a sighting recently over in the Caucasus of a tiger. Now, I mean, that's pretty impressive to me, that here this footprint evidence, which is the more substantial than just the anecdotes, shows a definitive ecological correlation here. Not that there's something magical about the presence of tigers. It's just like with black bears here in North America. They have similar habitat requirements. Not in this case, not necessarily diets, but wet, thick forest cover is necessary. Now, what about diet? There have been a couple of, we use the word omnivore, and you realize that's a very generic term. That covers a broad, I mean, that it just means they'll eat just about anything. But that list of food items is going to be restricted based on their morphology, their teeth and jaws and chewing muscles, as well as their gut physiology, their digestive physiology. Now, you think about a bear has evolved from a carnivore ancestor. Bears and other canids share a common ancestor. And the bear long snout, the teeth, which have become much more human-like in some ways than, say, your family dog. But still, and the gut, the length of the gut, their gut has elongated, but it's still derived from a carnivore's gut. A large primate ancestor, on the other hand, has a different adaptation. They tend to, when they have a diet that's varied, but includes tough, fibrous foods, tend to have flatter faces so they can load those back teeth, the molars and premolars, which often enlarge. The canines become smaller so that they don't interlock, which allows the jaws to slide back and forth side to side. The second phase of chewing, to really grind things. Instead of slicing things like a scissor with that carnassial that cats and dogs have back there, you know, you've seen a dog when they get a hold of that rawhide and they're really crunching down on it, they get it right over those premolars and molars that are like a pair of shears. Well, one of the animals that shows this kind of hypertrophy of the molars is Gigantopithecus. And little stubby canines and tiny cropping incisors up here. But, I mean, the premolars of Gigantopithecus were several times bigger than our molars. Molars are huge. The face is tucked back. The front part of the palate is abbreviated. Another species that shares that same kind of suite of adaptations, the same morphology, is the Paranthropus that we mentioned earlier. And what's really uncanny is here's a still from the Patterson-Gimlin film with a skull, and realize that we do have complete jaws of this individual, of this species, excuse me. It's just that this individual was only found with a skull, but this is based on other isolated jaws that match this species. But the point is, juxtaposing this skull, for which we have very complete specimens, very extensive specimens, look at the remarkable congruence in the proportions. The brain is pretty small. Paranthropus, remember we said, has a brain that's about, at most, 500 cc's. Chimpanzees, 350 to 400 cc's. The congruence with the brow, the position of the orbits, the zygomatic arch here, the jugal here, the cheekbone, the occlusal surface between the teeth, and these, indicating a very deep, deep upper jaw and lower jaw that's chinless. The flaring gonial here for the attachment of the masseter muscles. You can actually see that. You can see the shadow in front of that really deep masseter muscle that spans down from that flaring cheekbone down to the corner of the jaw. I mean, the point is, this creature has all of those adaptations that we see in Paranthropus and Gigantopithecus, which probably evolved them convergently, separately, but convergently to a similar niche, and is exactly what we might expect for a large omnivorous primate in a temperate forest, temperate habitat, where the food items are going to be diverse but include a lot of coarse, tough food items. Also, this agrees with the very consistent lack of a projecting canine, as described by eyewitnesses of Bigfoot. I lost my train of thought for just a second here. Oh, that was it. This was filmed when? A little quiz. 1967. These specimens weren't found until, and certainly weren't described and published until the late 70s. So the Sasquatch film actually anticipated by almost a decade the very adaptations that anthropologists only came to understand much later. What would have been the inspiration for a giant hairy ape in 1967? Who is the famous silver screen star? King Kong, which was based on a gorilla. I've got another slide in another presentation where I have jutting face, projecting lower jaws, big canine teeth. You know, why would Roger diverge so much and so perfectly anticipate what we came to understand? Well, and here's another little, just since we're on that note, we were talking about this earlier. When one of the specialists examined the Patterson film, he said, it's a fake. It's obviously a fake. Look at it. From the waist up, it looks like a gorilla. From the waist down, it looks like a hairy human with long legs. It's inconceivable that such a combination, such a mosaic of characteristics would be found in a hominid or any, in an animal, in nature. Inconceivable, right? Well, again, about 10 years later, more complete skeletons of Australopithecines like Lucy were found. And how was it described? From the waist up, it looks just like a chimpanzee. From the waist down, it looks like a hairy, short-legged human. Inconceivable, right? That's what they said 10 years earlier. It was inconceivable that such a combination of features. But once again, it anticipated what we now know. See, it took a while before that space in the puzzle board opened up and was framed by more accurate, more extensive current knowledge. So, when people ask me, do I believe that Gigantopithecus is the answer? Well, right now, if I had to posit two working hypotheses, it would be one or the other. Now, with Gigantopithecus, you've got something that's the right size, in the right place, at the right time to explain why there are reports of Sasquatch-like creatures in Eastern Asia and in North America. Because we know that there was an exchange. 75% of the species we consider native to North America actually immigrated here from Asia. 75%. So why not another large terrestrial ape? The problem here was, but we don't have any hind limb bones. We don't have a pelvis. We don't have a cranial base. We don't know for sure that it was upright, standing, and bipedal. But here we have a hominin that is bipedal, and bipedality seems to be unique to that hominin radiation. But it's in the wrong place at the wrong time, and it's only about 5.5 feet tall. How could it possibly, how can we really connect those dots? Well, that changed my mindset about that, and my paradigm shifted a little bit when the Hobbit was discovered, because all of a sudden here we have a species that must have been derived from a late Australopithecine, very early Homo, which was over here in Africa 3 million years earlier. So that species expanded its range clear into Southeast Asia, throughout Southeast Asia, persisted until 13,000 years ago. Why couldn't a robust Australopithecine, which lived much longer in Africa, up until about 1.2, 1.6 million years ago, have persisted and in short order have attained gigantic proportions, predator pressure or dietary adaptation, any number of things. There were lots of species that attained gigantic proportions during the Pleistocene. So those are the two working hypotheses for an origin. One of the things that really drives that home for me, I had the opportunity to go to China. And over there, they describe the Yeren, much more common that it's a reddish color, but it's otherwise descriptions just like a Sasquatch. And what was most remarkable is I was privileged to examine a pair of footprint casts. And this is it. This is it seen in angle. And you can see that it has this remarkable mid-tarsal pressure ridge that is virtually identical to the cast that was made by Bob Titmus at the Patterson-Gimlin film site in 1967. This was cast in 1992. This person had absolutely no knowledge of Sasquatch whatsoever, let alone Roger Patterson and these casts. In fact, this was cast before I published any of my discussion about the nature of that pressure ridge and the foot morphology, which we don't have time to go into, unfortunately, today. But so actually, I'm going to just jump ahead a little faster. So what are the forms of evidence? So now we've got a scientific context, we've got a biogeographical and ecological context. What are the kinds of evidence that come up? And we can kind of rank, well, I shouldn't say not necessarily rank them, but we can, from here down, I don't want to put this in a continuum of ranking, but although in some ways, I mean, well, anyway, either way, I don't want to diminish the significance of ethnographic traditions and those cultural perceptions. But here we have basically stories, anecdotes, and then audio, visual, photographic, trace, and physical. See, we're getting closer and closer to more substantial evidence. Trace evidence, you know, is still not physical evidence, but you've got a document, you've got a record. I mean, and you can do the same with photographic and visual and audio if it's done properly. All right, so let's talk about those cultural signs. I mean, it's amazing. This is a fascinating aspect, and I've been privileged to be included into some traditional stories and knowledge shared by good friends made on the Fort Hall Reservation, as well as numerous students who have taken some of my classes from the reservation that have shared their experiences growing up. But all sorts of depictions in some tribes are more open in their depictions, like in the Pacific Northwest, the totems and masks, clan crests, and so forth. Others are a little more subtle. The Shoshone, for example, it's often it can be just a geometric figure or a pattern of colors incorporated within a clan crest. Cobbles that are have many of the remarkable depictions of an ape-like head. This one found from the Columbia River Gorge. This comes from Wyoming and represents the Sovitza, and which is the eater of children. And we'll talk about that a little more. And remarkably similar here, this is the hairy man, the Yokuts in California. Hairy man plays a very central role in the creation story. And he's actually responsible for creating humans, standing upright like he does. But when the humans saw this giant hairy monster from their eyes, they ran and hid. And so the hairy man's weeping, sad about the rejection by its spawn, and vows to only frequent the remote forests at night so that it won't scare the humans. And footprints. And we're going to look at some of those, I guess, later. We were in Wyoming. I work a lot with John Myenzinski, who's a wildlife consultant. Amazing walking almanac of wildlife knowledge and ethnobotany. And this is Fred Chapman, who was previously the state archaeologist in Wyoming. We were investigating a site where there had been an encounter. I won't have time to go into all details, but what was most interesting at this particular point, this rock face, was this pictograph. And unfortunately, it was quite damaged, but you could still see. I mean, there were all sorts of depictions. And much as the Bushmen, the humans were mostly just stick figures. But they were involved in various activities and depictions of native life. And then this one stuck out. And even though it's damaged, you can see that it has broad shoulders, probably a tiny head that doesn't really show up much, but this arm with an upraised hand with all five digits clearly displayed, and then this thick body and the feet, flat, human-like feet sticking off to the side. Well, when I saw that, you know, I really perked up because I was familiar with this historic photograph of a Tsonequah costume from the Quetzal tribe up in the Northwest. And here you can see that mask with the stereotypical depiction of the pursed lips indicating the whistling call, and then the emphasis on these hands, these big hands, which the story goes, the Tsonequah, the cannibal giantess, she would, when the opportunity presented, snatch up children to take home for dinner. And they weren't the guests, they were the main course. And she would put pine pitch on her hands, like an NFL receiver, so that she could scoop them up and throw them in a basket on her back, a crude wicker basket. Thankfully, she was rather dull-witted, and so she would often fall asleep during her foraging, upon which the kids could pick their way through the wicker and climb out and run home. But this is why the children were always admonished to be home before dark, you know, had they had a curfew. And when they were out walking alone, they were never to whistle, because it would attract the Tsonequah. Now, as I pointed out, let's see, wait a minute, there's one more, there we go. Well, yes, and then there was this other one. I was thumbing through a book that had Anasazi pictographs, petroglyphs, and this one just jumped out at me. The remarkable similarity in the depiction. And then, as we pointed out earlier, this one here from Wyoming. Now, is this just coincidence? I mean, I'm not an expert by any means, or knowledgeable enough to interpret these. But I'm just struck by the remarkable consistency. And, of course, then the question comes up, too. Does it have anything to do with this sort of depiction? Again, those remarkably big hands. You know, the emphasis on those human-like features of the hands and the feet that differentiate this bear man from a bear, or bear woman, in this case. So, what are the identifications? Well, again, like I said, the field guide was motivated out of a desire to an opportunity and a desire to provide a tool to help people to better and more accurately identify and discriminate and report their information to me. I was so tired of getting photographs with no scale, no standard scale in the picture. You know, it just, you can never recreate that, and you've lost a very significant, a fundamental aspect of the character of that information. So how do we identify? So there actually are now a couple of field guides that do have a page with Sasquatch in them. And so in the style of a field guide, we've indicated with the red arrows the field marks, the distinguishing characteristics, you know, the lack of a protruding snout, the lack of ears up on top of the head, you know, the long legs. You know, when a bear stands up, it has a low crotch. Looks like some of these teenagers walking around town these days. Can never Yeah. And of course, quite different than you know, your typical person out in the woods, who usually will have some other accoutrements: a hat, a walking stick, a backpack, shorts with a hem, you know, or boots, those types of things. You know, now, one time I was challenged by this person on, it was an interview on a radio show, and he called in and he said, Dr. Meldrum, are you familiar with the work of Elizabeth Loftus? And I, you know, wasn't fully. I'd heard the name once he told me, the association, once he told me what she was known for, and she's a psychologist whose expertise is on the pitfalls and the psychology, rather, let's put it that way, the psychology of eyewitness testimony. And she has, you know, her work is cited endlessly in courtrooms when trying to pick apart, and justifiably so, because, you know, there's a distinction, though, and I put this little graph together, or diagram, to show that when you're talking about picking someone out of a lineup where a sample of similar-looking people are put there, and you have to decide, you know, whether this person or that person is the one who snatched the little old lady's purse, that's a very different challenge, different objective, than picking out the Sasquatch from the other lineup of potential characters out there. You know, and that was kind of lost on this caller, but he went on and on and on. You just can't rely on the eyewitness and eyewitness testimony. And certainly there are limitations, and the conditions of the encounter, the lighting, the duration, the state of mind of the individual, their experience in the field, the extent of the view of the creature, and so forth, so that every, you know, flash of fur in the bush doesn't turn into a Sasquatch. Those are important qualifications. But he went, and he was getting frustrated with my defense of the different types of evidence. And finally he came full circle and he says, if there was an 800-pound gorilla out there in the woods, somebody would have seen it. And I said, did you listen to what you just said? You started off this conversation by saying that you can't trust anything that anybody sees because of Elizabeth Loftus's work. Well, you know, there's something to be said. Photographic evidence. So we'll just do a little sampling of some of this very quickly. So I'm sure you've seen the Patterson-Gimlin film. And here it's not quite playing at the proper speed. It's not quite buffered well enough. But anyway, it's an amazing piece of film. And it set the bar so high that we are always very, at least I am, very skeptical, or very critical, put it that way. I don't want to say skeptical, but critical of the various little snippets of film that are proliferating on YouTube and so forth. Now, here is that piece of footage. In a way, I guarantee you, it's actually been posted, so you probably maybe have seen it online. Many of you will never have seen it online, though. You know, bear in mind that what you often see on the documentaries is a licensed VHS copy sometimes of the film that's provided to the producers of a documentary. In this case, what took place here was a very good copy, very clean copy of the film was photomicrographed, or microphotographed. I always invert that. Anyway, it was shot, digital images were shot through a microscope at the highest resolution that the film would support. You know, eventually you get the grain of the film, it doesn't make any sense to enlarge it anymore. Now, one thing that was known was that the camera that Roger used had a less expensive lens on it, one that was not corrected for chromatic aberration. Which simply means, as you know, as light passes through a lens, it's refracted, just like light shining through a glass of water will produce a rainbow effect. The different wavelengths of light refract at different points and will be focused, therefore, at different points adjacent to the film. So some colors will be in sharp focus, while others will be slightly out of focus. So in the digital age now, that raw image can then be imported into software that allows you to split those color channels and look at them individually. So what you find is, even though you lose a little bit of color information, you can subtract away the slightly blurry colors and leave just that crisp image. In this case, it was the red channel was the sharpest, but here it's rendered in grayscale. And then it's been stabilized, and it's playing, it's just a little bit slow there, as it's not quite buffering, but it's pretty close to the actual film speed. A lot of times when you see it playing, it's played at 22 frames per second, which is the broadcast, typical broadcast rate. If you're going to put something on TV, you would film it always at 22 frames per second. But there was a lot of, when Roger looked at his camera, whether it got bumped and moved or what, it was set lower. And through various independent means, it's been pretty well established that the frame speed was somewhere between 16 and 18 frames per second. And even though it's a snap dial, each camera has a slightly different performance. You know, it's a hand-wound camera. And so the nature of the spring can advance the film slightly different speeds. In any case, the point is that, as you look at this, that's closer to the way it was walking. A little slightly faster than that. That's just not quite playing to the right. But it gives a much more accurate impression of the massiveness, the inertia, the bulk of this creature. But as an anatomist, you know, I'll show this. I mean, this is so clear by comparison to anything that you've seen. It always irritates me when some of the skeptics, like Dr. David Daglin, makes the comment that the film is so poor, it's so blurry, you know, you can't even see facial features. You can see a lot of facial features on this. I mean, this was about the best conditions at the time that Roger took this, the best film that could have been used. But again, as an anatomist, you know, you start at the head and you just start working your way down and looking at things. You can see the way the muscles attach high up on the back of the head. Not as high as a gorilla, but certainly not up underneath as in a human or a human wearing a costume. That's one of the dead giveaways. When you see a costume and the person has a neck, and the head, this big round head, goes around and tucks way under before the neck starts, it's not a Sasquatch, because there isn't the brain for it, for one thing. It has a brain that's about the size of a gorilla relative to body mass. You can see those trapezius muscles coming down, supporting that big, heavy set of shoulders and arms. I mean, those arms are massive. Those arms are probably bigger than most of your legs in this room. You know? And so on down, you can see the erector spinae muscles along the back creating that dark furrow that a number of people keep saying is a zipper line. Other little details, like watch when her arm swings back as she turns. You can see there's a little fold of skin right there at the armpit, right in front of the armpit or the axilla, where the skin, the hair is very short, rubbed short. Right there, when it comes back through, watch right there. If you reach down the outside of your knee, you can feel a tendon that crosses your knee. That's the semimembranosus muscle. You don't see details like that in a padded fursuit. You just don't. I mean, the anatomy is just amazing. So we could sit here for 5 minutes. All right, footprints. The most common mistakes are made when misidentifying either human or bear. They're the two creatures out there that have five toes, have a rather plantigrade foot. In this case, we've got an example of an overstep where the hind foot has crossed, you know, it's walking just fast enough that the hind foot has crossed over the print of the forepaw and obliterated some of the toes. And so sometimes people see something like that that's a little more ambiguous and see an elongated footprint. But one of the big giveaways is that concavity right there at the back of the metacarpal pad on the forepaw, as opposed to the nice, full, rounded, broad heel of the Sasquatch, which is so characteristic. Tracks that have very narrow heels are suspect because, you know, as you increase linear dimensions, the volume is tripled, cubed. And so one way to disperse that weight is to increase the relative breadth. A lack of an arch, and this is usually a real dead giveaway. You see this kind of question mark, kind of a button hook right there around the well-differentiated ball, one of the points of support of the arch of the foot. So the arch rests on the heel and primarily the first and fifth heads of the metatarsals, these bones, short little bones through here. And that leaves a very distinctive void. Okay, and other details like that. Well, and the other thing with the bear, notice too, this is a real good tell, and that is the inside toe is the shortest. It's more like a little thumb, as opposed to the elongated toe of the Sasquatch or human foot. So here's some examples. One of the projects I'm involved with, you know, I have probably over 250 casts in my laboratory. We've 3D scanned the vast majority of those, and we're producing a digital archive that will eventually be annotated with information, provenience data, and so forth. But you just kind of get a little sense. Now, even the point, though, that's quite amazing is that at first glance, these may seem quite different and distinct from one another. But in reality, they're remarkably consistent. There are individual differences, yes, and there are differences based on the nature of the substrate that it was walking in, the mobility of the toes and the midfoot. So sometimes you get what looks like an arch, but it doesn't have that well-differentiated ball and that buttonhook shape to it. And we have, in this case, we have examples. In fact, one of them was out on the table of this same individual with a very, very distinctive big toe, shape of the distal pad, walking very flat-footed. Now, again, as tempted as I am, being the foot special, I can't talk about that anymore. So I got to wrap it up here real quick. Hair. One of the characteristics of the Sasquatch hair is the lack of a cellular medulla. So you can see here repeated examples from different places, you know, spanning from Texas to British Columbia, that all show this remarkably consistent anatomy. And it's hair, not fur. They don't possess this under, this downy, not downy, but short, fine under fur that has the insulative quality. But that lack of a cellular medulla has also been a challenge because in its absence, getting DNA from these isolated hair strands, these shed hair, have been remarkably difficult. So, it's been said, there is no history without legend. You know, our stories enliven our legacies, our heritage. But also, there is no legend without history. With very, very few exceptions, the stories that we tell are based on that kernel of truth. And so, you know, I started off with this mask, but the question, the fundamental question for me as a scientist is, what lies behind that mask? Is there a biological species behind the legend of Sasquatch? And that's the challenge that we face. Thank you. The question was the Patterson film, Gimlin film subject was a female. And yes, she was apparently a female. Had one of the characteristics of pendulous breasts. And given her size and the shape and proportions of her track, which was 14 and a half to 15 inches, but more parallel-sided, not quite so flaring. Still has a very broad heel relative to that size, but that's fairly typical of what we think are female tracks. Other examples of which we have found in company with infant footprints that range down to as small as 4, 4.5, 5 inches in length.
The Patterson prints.
Yes.
Are they compatible or similar to the ones in this case?
The examples that I've seen from here, and I haven't had a chance to peruse all of that information, hopefully do more of that tomorrow, seem to be consistent, yeah. I mean, hair color?
Yes.
Well, the color, from the examples that we have examined microscopically that I'm rather confident are attributable to Sasquatch, there are two fundamental pigments, pheomelanin and eumelanin. The pheomelanin is the reddish, blondish color pigment, and then the pheomelanin is the black melanin. And so what you get is the full spectrum where some individuals have just pheomelanin, and then you get reports of the almost white or buckskin color. And then as the black, the eumelanin proportion increases, it blends into brown colors, reddish brown, until you get up to black. And most people who, you know, unless it's at night or in the dusk or whatever, comment about that kind of almost a mahogany look where there's still a slight reddish tint to the black, at least under the microscope, that's what we see. So, and as far as silvering, that's just then a loss of pigment altogether with age, presumably. So just like you have a silverback gorilla, basically those hairs just have lost their pigment, don't produce any pigment whatsoever, and then are light-colored or light-tipped.
Yeah,
at that period. Now, this hair doesn't grow continuously. These hairs seem to grow to length, and they're worn off bluntly. They show no evidence of cutting ever. Well, based on more, I'm an anatomist rather than a molecular biologist, and so I'm not going to just ignore the anatomy when we fail to get DNA out of it. But identifying hair is a bit of an art as well as science. It requires an extensive comparative sample and lots of comparisons on the microscope. So people have largely now, given the availability of DNA studies in wildlife studies, rely on the DNA analysis. And so there's fewer people who are doing, academically, doing hair analysis. It falls to the commercial hair and fiber, the CSI type of things, criminal investigations and litigations and so forth. But when you've got hair that I put under microscope and I cannot attribute it, I mean, the only thing that these hairs could be otherwise is human. There is no other animal out there. I mean, unless someone is going, even if you went out and plucked some orangutan hair from a specimen at a zoo and sent it to me under the guise of a Sasquatch hair, they would be distinguishable from the hairs that we're finding. But they're always, on one of the TV documentaries, Lynn Rogers, a famous bear biologist up in Minnesota, examined some hairs that we collected from that screw board up at Ontario at the lake, which I had nothing to do with, by the way, so don't send me any hate mail like so many people did. It was already there when I was invited to come. But when we pulled those hairs off and he examined them, that was what he said. He said, if the only thing these could be is human, but they're not cut. So I would have to say, if I was pressed to identify it, I'd say it was a wild man, a wild person, who never had been to a barber. Yes, sir. Well, that's a good question. The thing is, the only way I can gauge that is on my experience, and I'm limited to the information. If I'm thinking about looking in a new area or contact people in a new area, the first place I go, because it forms a baseline, is the BFRO's database. Because it's just a jumping off point. I mean, there's a lot of fluff in that database, I know. But what I find is when I go somewhere and I talk to the local people, like here, I get story after story after story after story that are never publicized, and that's understandable. So it's hard to pick out a place. So people usually think of the Pacific Northwest. But Idaho gets a lot of reports, but Idahoans just, in the past especially, before the advent of the internet, don't talk about it, even now. They don't talk about it publicly much. I get people who come up to me, I get stopped in the grocery store or restaurants and people sharing their stories, and they'll say, you're the first person I've told this story to other than my wife. Sometimes even she doesn't know about it. So I better quit. Okay. Thank
you. Hello, how's everyone doing today? My name is Robert Kreider. I come from a little different background than Mr. Meldrum. I run a professional exploration, research, and recovery company for about 30 years now. And I got into the Bigfoot subject mainly because we had experienced the creatures in the field so often. And hearing that there seemed to be a block between the scientific or the credible evidences and the hype or the hobbyist, and we decided at one point in 2010 to apply our expertise, technologies, and personnel into taking a serious look at the subject and hopefully to bridge that gap, maybe to go where science can't go because of a fear of being blacklisted or lack of funding or resources. We decided to put that to ourselves. I think for lack of time here, we're just going to run right through what we've got on the board. I know you guys want to get to some video. So we have here is obviously the state of New Mexico, and as Mr. Meldrum said, we definitely have the ecology to support within narrow avenues in the state. Of course, they're widely separated, so activity and travel has to take place between these areas as well. These conduits of activity seem to come down, stem down from the lower Rockies and to spread out amongst some of the other mountainous regions. Of course, you can tell that what type of areas and topography would have to be crossed in order to get to these other regions. The surprising part about this is instead of just in the mountainous areas of our state, we also have evidence and have been doing research with success in some of the more remote mesalands of the state that would be considered potentially too dry to support the species. Of course, in these areas, there are also many drainages, stock ponds, water tanks, and other sources of water that could be utilized, but obviously for smaller population. Okay, so here's one of the water sources I was just speaking about. This is in one of the more desolate areas of the state. And as you can see, it's a man-made reservoir that allows for wildlife and other things that may not be able to live around those areas to prolificate. We've noticed a range of about 10 miles from water sources is not out of the question. These mesaland areas can be broken up and very tight and very remote. So as far as activity and interaction goes, they're prime locations because not many people get into these areas, as I'm sure many of you know. Also, game is very prevalent out there. There's more animals available to eat as a food source and also plants, roots, and things like that in these areas than people would consider. After, I know, living out there myself for a number of years on and off on different projects, I've been able to procure plenty of food sources just within myself as a human to make it so, let alone a creature that's highly efficient. These mesalands are vast and like, as I said, unoccupied, but they are very remote. So it takes traveling anywhere from 60 to 100 miles in between location. Of course, the locomotion and the speed of the animal appears to be at a decent walk, about 10 to 12 miles an hour. So you can see it wouldn't take as long as we would think to cross those gaps. In a single night, they could cross a 100-mile gap to get from one environment to another. So one of the first areas we're going to discuss, and just very briefly for lack of time, this is the what we call the PLSA and the CRST research areas. Both of these are in the Sandias just behind Albuquerque. The PLSA area actually begins and starts only about 150 feet above the affluent homes there. We found through research that they actually borrow items from the landscaping, even as tool use, and they'll frequent the water gardens and ponds of these people's homes. So they're not as shy about entering into the neighborhoods as we might think. Some of our best evidence was actually gleaned at the PLSA area, less than 100 feet in elevation above the homes that are there in that area. That was during a study for the Museum of Zoology in Lausanne, Switzerland, along with Oxford study. Now, you should be in line, but apparently they're not. This is one of the areas we did. Of course, you can see it's a similar isolated region in the Chusca Mountains for UNM. This is one of the DNA evidence gathering locations based on a sighting report. Doing the investigation on this, we were able to get off at the top of the mountain, track the creature down about 3/4 of a mile to the witness sighting area without knowing where the witness sighting area was. So not only did that type help us validate that whatever he saw, we were tracking. Along that, we were able to find, as I'll show you in a few minutes, everything from scat to several hair specimens and samples, some even having the follicle and a little bit of flesh where he ground his leg. So this is another one of our research areas that we're dealing very heavily in. This is one of the main sites, is the small river band at the top. It's called the GLST area. And we have a family unit there that since 2010 has been occupying the river valley and using the micro environment in here and the bosky region to rear its young. So apparently the female and a few of the young stay in that region all the time, and the larger males and some of the larger adolescents that accompany them venture into the river bottom and back out. But they seem to spend very little time actually in that area. It's for the most part what we've seen family activity. And this includes, we've seen for 2 years in a row where they've birthed children in there, or I should say young, in there, and they were 1 year apart, which was a little strange for us because we didn't think that they'd be that close together. We see the males go active from the river bottom and then use the high mountains to as a point of refuge. and also probably hunting, and just to stay away from the family unit and reduce the chance that the family gets discovered. It seems to be very important in their behavior that all along in what they do, especially as they mature, they don't want to attract attention to themselves, and we could all see why. And apparently they go to great efforts to not only learn this through trial and error, but as well to be teaching it to each other. Some of the things we've seen expressed could not be learned in a single lifetime. They would have had to be passed down from one generation to another, just like we do today. Ways to avoid humans and survive. This is another picture of the GLST area I was going to bring up because I want to mention. So you have these two large drainages that come down and feed this. And right about the center area, we have what we call the domicile area. And or it's here. The domicile area is where most of the rearing and the raising of the young and things happen. It is the most remote, thickest, heaviest bosque anywhere on the river system. What we have along here, constant reports of things like dogs being killed, things like goats and things like that, other livestock seem to be a little more rare. But the dogs, anyway, since they bark and they alert to the presence of the animals, they seem to get taken out sometime. I think just to preserve the integrity of the group and lessen the chance of being discovered. We've also recorded dogs encountering them and them having to kill the dogs, as well as them just scaring dogs. And the difference being is an infant was born and with the family within a few months. And when the dog got there to the encounter, instead of just running the dog away with noises, it went ahead and killed the dog. Now, we assume this is because of the overprotective parental nature of the animal. This is an overview of the main domicile area after a major flood. So in this case, they have not reoccupied this. So often the habitat doesn't allow for the continuation of survival in that region. So they move through these riverbeds, one, I'm sure, to a resource, or the resources do not get depleted. So where they are in one day, they may not be the next, or week to week, or month to month. Also changes with the environmental conditions, like when a major flood sweeps through and removes a lot of either their construction and bedding or the underbrush, which conceals them, as it did in this case. That's another look at the domicile. Now here we have an example that everybody can do on using Google Earth to track. Since these riverbeds change frequently, and also nowadays they are photographing from space on a tighter schedule, we have less interval in between without things happening. We can actually use some of the Google Earth images to do some of our tracking and recon work. This picture was actually taken within 2 weeks of us following the family unit through the area. And what we see in this photograph is a singular biped trackway amongst the horses and cattle, where the tracks are split out to a full 5 foot step gap, consistent all the way through. And this runs down the riverbed for about half a mile. And you can see here we have the domicile location and our trackway, right, contingent there directly together with each other. I'd like to just go ahead and we're going to go on to the different locations. So we can jump back real quick to a historical listing of the animal. This is from the GLST. This is a few of the prints from the family unit. And we only do most of this research in midwinter. So these prints, almost all of them were taken in temperatures below 10 degrees, some of them negative 5. And these feet, whoever they belong to, were walking through the snow, ice, and the water during these times of year every night, not during the day. We could go back and repetitively find new prints put placed there at nighttime in below freezing weather, in the snow, and in the water, in the mud. Now, if they were a human, they would almost have to be a feral variety of human, since the standard human could not tolerate that type of exposure for that long a period of time. In comparison, we have a print or a photo. We can get to it here. This is actually another family unit from upstate Michigan. And you can see the similarities in not just the overall size variant, and these are all pretty small tracks. This one's about 13 inches long, and then we have the junior right down here, about 7.5. And what we see is in this variance right here, and even in the type of feet, a similarity to what we can find in upstate Michigan. And it's also the same environment. This is a kayaker sent me these because they looked a lot like what we had. And he had found them in a very, very remote location while he was kayaking and went to the riverbank to get some rest. Now, he said he was probably 20, 30 miles from anywhere that a human could have walked to at that point in time. And the unique thing about when we look at these two, both the GLST set and this, we have several variants in size here, and some are narrow and thin and quite curved, while others are medium robust. If we look one more time, this is a set of tracks from a little over 3 million years ago. Now, we see, in a sense, the same family behavioral system in a mud flow or on a riverbed somewhere, and walking with about the same size individuals as what we see here. So the commonality of occupying a riverbed system as a place to live or environment to raise young in is certainly not new. For what we've seen in the field for diet, it can be quite varied. They'll eat everything from ginberries in when they're ripe in this season, which are high in vitamin C, and of course they're also astringent. They help mouth bacteria, gut bacteria, and other things. And we find them eating, get to the next picture here, a lot of the vegetable matter in midwinter. So some of the river systems, even in below freezing temperatures, based on where they are and the conditions, can hold algae and even other green leafy plants throughout the year. They seem to be utilizing these as a resource as well in these river systems. Another thing they're eating, or apparently, is pine nuts, not just pinon, but standard pine cone nuts, and as well the dust from trees from the beetle larvae. So not just the grubs themselves. And we found that kind of surprising. We found several bits of evidence of that in the scat as well as in the feeding remnants in the logs and things themselves. Where most animals would just pick out the grubs, they would also eat the sawdust that the grub deposits inside the wood and leaves behind. Another food source that was surprising to us, and it doesn't seem like you'd get a whole lot by doing it, was the base of both Spanish bayonet and yucca. And what they would do is either pull the entire plant out of the ground, which is not easy to do if you've ever tried it, and then they would strip the leaves off and bite a portion of the bottom of the leaf. And in these, that should have been there. In this shot even, you can see the edge and the bite imprint from the subjects, and not like anything that's out there that we're aware of, because it seems to have a similar bite pattern to a human being. Now, we found thousands and thousands of these examples, which would have represented a tremendous amount of food procurement. This is scat material from one of the subjects, which it contains porcupine quills. So whether that was accidental or not, but it just shows the ability to eat what it wants to, where it wants to, when it wants to. Something that we've found is probably a mainstay that has allowed them to travel to these new and diverse areas is the infiltrators of Russian olive. Russian olive puts out a fruit that is extremely high in carbohydrates, and it lasts year-round on the floor of the bosque. It can be collected in great quantities per day. We found that almost across the board, every individual that defecates along the river systems is leaving Russian olive. So it seems to be something that all of them sustain themselves on. And as I said, it is available year-round. This is another example. Another example of Russian olive on the floor of the bosque and how it usually lays. It's quite deep and dense. One of the other food items they seem to go after is fowl, birds. And what we've noticed in feeding behavior is to lay low in bird roosting areas and just observe where the birds go. And if anyone knows anything about birds at night, very few of them can see. And if you're quiet and calm, you can literally walk up and pluck a bird right out of the bush as long as you know where it is. In many cases, they're following woodpeckers, what this is, to the hole where the woodpecker lives. And then, of course, once the woodpecker returns to the hole, simply extracting the woodpecker out of the log itself. One of the unique things they do, though, is they pluck the feathers. There's almost never any blood or sign of the rest of the bird whatsoever. And almost as a whole, the feathers are put in a nice little pile, just like this. And you can see they also do it down into the brush down there where they do have some cover. Now, this is the old stuff from 1995. You can go online and use my name in a search and access this video from 1995, and this is what was found congruent to it. So this was early photo enhancement using really early digital software. Of course, in 94, most of this stuff even came out. So it was sampled at about a half of a mile in this video, and we used a type of software called Snappy that had just been declassified at this point in time, and we brought it into a workstation and were able to, even at that range, to distinguish eyeballs, lips, fingers, the partial holding of the arms, the way it holds its body. This individual, scaled from these pictures, would have been over 11 foot tall. We encountered him for about 8 years on and off, so it certainly wasn't anything new. But the ability to try to get a photograph is just, it's amazing, it's crazy. And we tried. I did get a video of him, and it's about 45 seconds or a minute, like I said, but it's at a half mile, and it's not the greatest in the world because we were not expecting to do it. This is scat from that same individual. After 2 weeks later, we returned to check the anomaly to see if anything was there or not, and we found both tracks that were not very good, and as well, with tracking the individual out, we managed to find scat. This scat would have been far too large for any of the animals that occupy that area that leaves this form of defecation. It would have been about twice the diameter. This is dehydrated. It would have been about twice the diameter when it was deposited. Now I'm going to go ahead and down for time purposes here. We're just going to go real quick. Okay, so this is the Ortiz area. This is ORTZ. This is the group that, another one of the group we've been doing recently. And you can see the type of terrain that they're occupying. There's a lot of scrubland in between, but these mountainous regions that we're seeing them in are actually quite dense and very inhospitable. We've also noted, as a behavioral trait, they seem to prefer slopes over 40 degrees. So the slope we see here, as an example, on this mountain, would be about the minimum of what they feel comfortable on as far as just staying, feeding, running around on. Anytime that they've been on flatter ground than this, they've seemed to be sketchy. They seem to be hyper-aware and seem to be flighty. Once into these steeper terrains, they're a lot more, I would say, forthcoming to the people, to where they can hide and evade us faster, so they'll often come in closer on steeper terrain. Now this is an example of feeding as well, and there's a difference in the way bears do this and the way a Sasquatch does this. Oftentimes, the bear will claw and pull down on the wood and bite and pull up, always leaving claw marks, teeth marks, or other abrasions on the wood. In a situation like this particular example, there's absolutely no scratch marks, claw marks, or teeth marks anywhere on the wood. Some of the wood has been picked up straight up and set to the side and laid back down on the log. And when the top of the log is removed, and then they dig straight down into the log and not forward into the log, though it's consistent with a bear. We believe, of course, this is feeding on grubs. They also feed on the ground grubs from the large gypsy moss in particular, and we've seen them lift rocks up to 1,000 pounds straight up, set them over, and put them back down. And then there's very seldom any digging or clawing to retrieve the grubs. They're very, very good at just fingering them directly out of the hole and leaving very little ground disturbance as they do it. So you can also see there's a friendly little doe there. The deer in the area, this is the funny part about areas we've seen a lot of Bigfoot and Sasquatch activity. The deer seem to be less startled by human beings in this area. And we believe this is because of less predation by other top-tier predators. It seems consistent with when the Bigfoot are in the area, we have an absence of mountain lion, and in most cases, bear as well, where the other top-tier predators have vacated the area due to the Bigfoot presence. And so where we have a constant Bigfoot presence, like at this location, many times the deer will walk right up to you. And it's the hunting, the way that they do their hunting, they don't disturb the main herds as often. They'll move them down slope to a pinch point, and then seem to selectively take one. And even those with deer, as long as you don't startle the rest of the herd, you're good to go on the next round. These are feet print recently turned in on a sighting report where the person watched the subject cross the road at high speed in bipedal fashion. And when it went over the edge, it just, as he said, just vanished, which seems strange to him. So we did a follow-up investigation, and we're able to find both an old set of prints and this set of prints that were just a few hours old. As you can see here, the prints themselves are 17 plus inches long, and the standard step gap is from 4.5 to 5 feet. I don't know if you've ever tried to take a step like that, but it's not easy. And you can see here, he's also following trackways from a large rabbit. And then we saw where the few days before that, he had been following trackways of an elk, a small elk. Now you can see a comparison there, the size. That's a size 10 snow boot. That's the foot next to it. Now some of these guys get quite a bit bigger than that. And as I'll bring up for you and show you real fast, this is the study we did at the request of Oxford, actually. And they wanted samples from what they confidently felt was a living subject. And we were able to do this. We gathered evidence less than 2 hours old and was supported by trace evidence in the form of handprints, footprints, food remnants, tool remnants, the remains of cooperative hunting from three different individuals as they moved deer down to the large individual who was awaiting with a rock that weighed about 150 pounds. This is a 20-inch plus track from that individual. This is one of the trackways that it came down with. It's an 8-foot step gap, each one down. And then he plants and then goes easy. And what he did was he just swung just around the corner here and got low, and he was carrying a large rock. And then they moved a deer down to him, and he apparently took that out at that location because the deer prints stop there, and his prints continue off, and no more deer prints. There's a close-up of step C. Now, this is embarrassing for me to show you and admit to you. This is the largest track I've ever seen, and I didn't recognize it for what it was. I thought it was a dual print, and what we can see here is this is the heel area to the foot, and then we have the little toe, and the next toe, the next toe, the next toe, and the large toe, or the great toe, is diverged off to one side here. And we can clearly see it sitting off to the side. Now, as you'll see, I cast... Well, we're going to go back and forth here just a little bit. Okay, so I cast that print. And when I did, you can see here, I cast shy. I thought I had a handprint and a footprint because I wasn't familiar enough with the hyperflexibility of the foot. So from what we can see, the foot can bend not only posterior, but to a great degree anterior. It can spread out. It can slip side to side. And the great toe structure can diverge up and down a lot like our thumb on our hand can. And it can also run out to the side to a great deal. So when I saw this, I cast to this point, which was 19 inches. And you can see here, they go far beyond 19 inches. The estimated length of this track in total is 24 to 25 inches. And we did bring these casts, and we will have them available for you guys to look at tomorrow. This is the location where we got the hair. This is a unique location because it's an observation point over the housing area at Piedra Lisa Trailhead in Albuquerque, one of some of the most affluent homes. People did not want to hear that. This observation point looks right down onto some of the nicest homes that's there. And what it is they keep track of the people that are on the PLSA trail so they can base their activity and movement and not be discovered. So this is the actual location. And what we do is we need, before we collect evidence or samples anymore, we generally don't take them unless there is supporting trace evidence. In this case, we found tracks leading up to about a 14-foot vertical climb up a rock wall. At the top of that rock wall was this large overhanging tree. When the subject went up through the tree at the top of the wall, he apparently grabbed a branch and broke the branch off, and just above that left a 6.5-inch gray hair strand, not fur, hair. That sample was submitted to the Oxford study, but per their information, it was never tested, even though it should have been knocked out or qualified based on the morphology alone. Should have been identifiable. They said it was not identifiable, yet they did not test it and include it in their study. And in all actuality, what they reported to the AP, to the Associated Press, is in direct contradiction to the letters I have from Brian Sykes. So whether they were intimidated to release the truth about their study or not, I don't know. That sample is still being curated in the Museum of Zoology in Lausanne, Switzerland. This is the cast of that large print that I just talked about with you. And what you can see here is I just managed to get the small toe, and then the next toe is even cut off. And let's not do that. And what we have, we can also see in this photo, is dermal patterning or patterning to the foot. And I didn't understand this print until we had done a lot more print work to, because the way it is spread out and the way the bone structure is. It obviously, from print to print, as Dr. Meldrum stated, that some of the prints can look far different than others. Some can look like they hold an arch based on how the foot is being held at that time. Other times it can look quite flat, or even to where some of the bones seem to protrude abnormally out of the bottom of the foot, as in this case with the second bone here below this toe. This is a handprint from the same individual. This handprint, I didn't have any plaster left at this time or I would have cast it. This handprint measured 16 inches from the base of the palm to the tip of the finger. That's absolutely massive. It is literally twice the length of my hand. If that's proportionate to the body structure, then it also gives validity and credence to a witness report there that this individual grabbed his black lab off the trail with one hand directly in front of him, greatly disturbing him. He quoted this animal at over 14 feet tall, and I would tend to think that's a gross exaggeration, but even an animal 12 foot tall would be uncomprehendable to most of us. If you stick a 6 foot stick on top of my head, and you realize that's where its head is, and then you take its shoulder width at 6 to 7 feet for that height, and then the overall girth of a large primate, what you're looking at is not something like what we see rebuilt on most of these shows. These animals can be absolutely massive, a lot bigger than we're giving them credit for in many areas. And I'll show you, we'll try to go on. This is the 150-pound rock that he actually threw at the deer and the position that it landed in. And you can see the type and shape of that rock once hurled. Now, we also had 6 people on this slope searching for where that rock came from. And these people are not new to this type of work. I'm going to go right into the GLST only because we're such in lack for time and I want to get some of this stuff shown to you. So let me get back where our pictures should start here. So this is the Galisteo area. The female was walking through this area. We were on an elevated position, and she was about a half mile from us. And before I could get the camera up, she had already turned around and started to move right on first sight, and she picked up a smaller individual that stands about 6'5", who we call George. He's often left as the babysitter. What we have here is one of the ways we qualify the imaging is this is a vector scope. It works on light frequency, not visible light. So everything out there has a different frequency. So we may see the same color in two objects, let's say a stump or a Sasquatch, but the light frequency will be far different that's coming back off that animal. What we've noticed doing this is we've been able to isolate the frequency of light that comes off of these types of animals. And it is far different than anything else out there. Theoretically, a vector scope could be built as a detection system that could identify a Sasquatch in any frame. And here you see, in the bottom center of the frame is the actual female standing in her position. And then this is a rough scaling at the time based on known tree heights. This was verified and it blew our mind because she was bigger than we thought. We were conservative. In this shot, you can see it drawn up and the contrast changed a little bit. And you can actually see George's arm around her shoulder, and here his leg, and here his other arm where she's carrying him away. This shot here is after it's been through the vector scope and cleaned up just a little bit. There's been no other modifications other than removing the dark spot under her legs. This here is still George's arm and George's arm wrapped around here. In this view, through the vector scope technology, we can make out her eye socket, the bottom of her chin, and just George's face looking around her a half mile away up at us as she totes him out of the way. Now, we consider George a juvenile. And as I said, he stands between 6'3 and 6'5 based on witness sighting reports. This was actually the position we were shooting this from, and I'm at the base of this hill. She spotted us from a half mile away, just cresting the top of this hill, and noticed us like that, and was instantly grabbing the kid and getting him out of Dodge. Now here's the actual scaling. We did a revisit on the site. We measured her placement, and we found knowns in the photo that give us our heights for scaling. You can see Reese in the lower left of the picture there with a rod. That's looking at 6'4" is the top of that rod. Now we can look at the upper left photo and see where 6'4" touches that female. and it's just about in the elbow height or center of the back when she reaches back. The upper left is an accurate scale measure of that female, and she scales at 11 foot slightly crouched. So if she stood fully erect, she would probably push 11 and a half to 12 foot tall. And you can look, if this was a suit, do you see how many Reese's would fit in the suit? You could slide two of them down either one of her legs without a problem. You know, just to, as I said, we're really crunch time. We just have a couple minutes. So I'm going to run through some very fast for you guys who may be out there in the field doing your own research, any of this stuff. We'll run through these images of what scat specimens look like so you can see. And I don't know why we're doing that. Okay. And please note that how compacted they are with Russian olive seeds. Now, they don't bite them, and I've tried it, and the reason being is they're extremely bitter. So it's very easy to remove the husk and the sugary substance on the outside without having to bite in them. And they don't seem to be too picky about just swallowing. Every time, no matter what the scat contains, you're going to see the same thing. It's full of Russian olive. No matter what time of year it is as well. Now, sometimes we do see what apparently looks like the leftover of meat ingestion or meat proteins. These have been checked a couple of times and verified, not in every scat sample, but most of them look like this when they're eating both of those food sources when they're both available. They'll also eat sand. They'll eat sand and algae and then defecate sand. This is something that not only that Sasquatch do, people have been known to do this as survival tactic as well. What we look ahead of us here is an infant scat. So this is from carrying the infant around the river bottom, and for the most part they apparently are feeding the infant algae at this stage when they're switching over from the lactate to solid foods. And scat placement. Scat placement is usually either along a water source, either near its edge or below the embankments, or behind bosques in a sheltered region where you have an elevation at least on two sides of you. They seem to all go in the same locations, and they do not like to defecate, of course neither do we, in our living room. So they're very much the same way. They don't just go everywhere. They have their locations they retreat to in order to do that, and most of the time they seem to do it as a unit. This is tracking one of the infants, or one of the very small subjects, and he was going down the river and picking out algae and setting it on the bank. Now, this is another, of course, scat location back behind everything. And in this case, we can see the remnants of a wild bird feeder somewhere. This is bird food for most of the jay foods because it's got the black sunflower seeds and the corn and stuff like that. So it's a wild bird mix. We actually tracked down the house that he was hitting to get this stuff from. And I think we'll move right into audio. So we're just almost completely out of time, and I apologize for that. I guess real quick, let's hit this. This is George, and who we call Amos is George's little brother. There was about a four-day snowstorm with 35 to 50 mile an hour winds at temperatures around 20 degrees. The night that snow stopped after 4 days continual, this family had left their little ranch, and while they were gone, something came in and got some of their goats. The only thing is it didn't remove any of the goats, and it didn't eat any of the portions of the goats. It literally broke the doors on the latch, and they broke the top. So the damage where the hinges were popped off, and you'll see here the latch was completely removed. I'm going to just run through. These are large footprints from George. They're 13-inch. What you'll notice is the majority of the damage to the door was at the top, where they pushed on the top of the door and literally ripped the screws out before the latch broke off. Then they left hair on the tops of the door sills, which are at 6.5 feet. And these, again, are the tracks approaching the ranch. We tracked them about 1,000 feet all the way back into the river bottoms, and were able to recover hair on the top of these gateposts. Where they had one, George had gone over one gatepost, Amos had gone over the other gatepost. Now these are maybe a little morbid, I'm sorry for that, but it's important to note. The goats were killed by abrasion to the neck, like a rug burn, or when you grab someone's arms and twist. Whatever had done this, grabbed him by the head and the neck and twisted with so much pressure that it literally took the hair out of the skin and left horrible bruising and abrasion marks around that area without any other major damage to the animal. Most of the animals were laid directly down and never moved from the point they were laid down. All of the animals, however, were punctured. They were punctured in the carotid artery and in the femoral artery. That is a method for removing the blood from an animal. These creatures are not the only ones that do that. Many humans in different areas, cultures, and tribes do the very same thing, especially in winter months when the need for high iron and other things that there are in the salt. So after 4 days of extreme blizzard conditions, apparently George, a younger, went up there and did this with Amos. We don't believe that the group dynamic would have condoned this because the group lives. That matter of fact, that picture of that mother carrying the young was taken less than 1,000 feet from where these goats were. Her or any of the larger individuals don't seem to hurt the livestock. I believe they don't want to attract any attention to themselves, just like a fox or anything else that lives maybe in an urban environment will do. But the juniors now, being hungry and being without, and without having as much regulation over their activity, they did apparently go in and do this. So you can see the puncture marks. That's completely to the femoral artery, and there's no blood around the goat. There was also no blood on the ground, and there was no blood left in the animals. Let's move right on into, I know we're already over time. I hate to do that. I would love to get a few sounds played for you guys. I don't know who's heard these creatures before. Are we ready to roll sound, Joe? Let's try this. Now, at the end of some of these were amplified and filtered because they were at such great distances. We use actually a 36-inch parabolic dish we designed, and we capture most of these audio at over 2 miles from the group. We found that tracking them by sound has been just as good as tracking them on the ground, even better in most cases. Now, about mid-play in this, I'd like you to listen for the human quality. They also do interactive howling and singing together and harmonizing as well. So when the male would come in and rejoin the group often, the family would get excited and begin to vocalize back. And once together, sometimes they would all vocalize in harmony at the same time. And if this cut will play, we'll move on. Really like it. Okay, that's not it. Yeah, it is it. We'll let that loop. So you can hear after the start of that two or three other individuals join in a harmonic with them. And on a spectrum analyzer, you can see each individual. So you can hear all the other four individuals come in and begin to harmonize. And we've put these against every known species that lives in North America so far with a spectrum analyzer, and they don't match anything. The longest so far, we recorded a 16-second howl. I don't know if any of you ever tried that, but... So they're a lot more complex as well than just the average howl. As you can hear here, there's more going on back and forth between individuals cutting off in strange places in the howl, things like that, would generally mean that there's going to be some type of meaning to that. I'm not going to say it's a sentence structure, but... If you were to take a full breath and absolutely at the top of your lungs make the loudest noise you can, count how many seconds that takes you to expend all your air. Well, you'll notice in a lot of these, they just seem to keep and go on and on. And as I said, we recorded one 16 seconds, which I have not been able to find any. Joe? Okay, so we're going to try to play. I know I'm already over the limit, you guys. You can stop me whenever you can. If this will play, this is a nighttime video that was shot on the San Juan River. We are completely, absolutely surrounded by a family group, and they're not going anywhere. They were here for about 4 hours. We were in and out with them. During these clips, like in that clip, there's eye shine, and if it's going to play straight, it's kind of flashing. We were scared of that with this computer. But these also can be seen online, just not at this resolution. We're going to let this play out. Now, a rock flies that just went by, we'll do it again, it flies right by Junebug's head, coming from the left to the right in the screen. And with a sketchy player like this, it may not barely be visible. It'll show in another clip right here. Sorry for that. We didn't have time to try this ahead of time, so. And it's very difficult to see. So during this, though, they threw in 4 rocks at us, and we thought we knew where every individual was, and we thought we were pretty good. Well, we're not. 2 had managed to sneak around the back side of us and were probably 15 to 20 feet behind our legs as we lay prone on the ground. And I didn't know it until we watched this. And what you'll see in this, in the second part here, is a rock that comes through directly behind my head from straight behind me, and we had no clue. They're throwing rocks over us in the dark. And I'm not using this light, but if you look center frame here, hopefully with the flashing, you'll see it come in right there. You can hear it. And that come just missed me. And then I'm moving is why. Now, they're basically doing what we would do to toy with someone. Sneak up behind them, throw a rock on the other side of them in the dark. Throw a rock on the other side. Well, we messed around with this group for about, literally, on and off for about 3 hours. And we had subjects as close as 8 feet to us that some of the eye shine shows. In this final clip, let this play out. I hope so. In this final clip, this is actually the eye shine of a juvenile who finally got nervous and not only threw a rock at us, but hit us. And he threw the rock probably 50 to 60 miles an hour. And if we hadn't had gloves and other things in my pocket, move up here where we can catch it. If I hadn't had gloves and other things in my pocket,
I caught it.
Here we go. There's that post. That's an eyeball. And he just hit me.
Did you suffer?
And here in a second, you'll see it flipped into the negative. Now, we could see.
Okay.
This is a semi-full moon night, and we could actually see into the darkness there what was crawling up. This does not give it justice, per se. The rock they hit us with is about 1.5 pounds. If it had hit anyone in the ribs, it would have broken them. It would have broken arm bone. If it had hit us in the head, it would have been fatal. And there's your culprit right there.
We were really, really lucky it hit us where it did. And we did, at this point, I actually mute the video because you can. I wasn't very coherent at this time and I was cussing. I was scared and I was a little mad because I thought we were all doing pretty good together, and then the little guy has to come out and throw a rock at us. And now what you see now is actually I shine from the larger individuals, multiple individuals, as they're following us down the road as we back up. So when I spoke up, a larger individual stepped out into the opening, and that smaller one came out up behind him. And it was almost kind of like, don't mess with my little brother type of sort of thing. In a way, they're a little bit thuggish because they were playing with us, and they really, really could have hurt us bad. My only consolation is, even at the age of the juvenile, he was probably 6.5, 7 foot, based on the heights we could see crawling, was that he probably easily could have hit us in a fatal shot if he'd have wanted to. I just have the feeling that they're that accurate. So if he would have wanted to hit us in the head and take us out, he probably could have done that. But I'm going to have to conclude, you guys. Thank you very much. Out of time.